This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Local historian, author, and cartographer Rick Britton joins us every Friday afternoon for a history discussion. We'll continue that theme. You know, last half hour, we're just talking history, and that sounds
right.
Like a pretty cool thing they're working on.
Absolutely.
Right?
Can't wait to see that.
And folks should know, if they're interested in any of that, our own Ed Lay did a terrific book. What is that?
Tell folks what it is. It's the Architecture of Jefferson's Country. And I think there's a date, but I forget what the dates are on it. But people can Google it, K. Edward Lay or Edward Lay, and they can find the book.
It's just
fantastic.
At the University of Virginia, of course.
Yeah, he taught architecture in the A school there, I think, probably, and he's probably listening. Hi, Ed. 15, 20 years at least, I think.
Yeah, and the
great
book
guy.
The book is just beautiful. It really is, you said, it is the best. I mean, tons of pictures. If I'm not mistaken, there was even a CD-ROM that
there
comes
is.
With it.
There is a CD-ROM with additional photographs and maps to accompany the book, things that they couldn't get in.
Yeah, and it documents the history of architecture in Charlottesville and Albemarle.
That's right. That's right. All the different styles. I learned a lot. I've got a copy of it. It's a great book.
Yeah, and of course, this exhibit that the architects are working on to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the American Institute of Architects, they're looking wider afield. They're going to be looking into the valley and further north of here and taking in a much bigger scope.
But Ed's book, too, does, too, because it's not just Jefferson's County, it's Jefferson's Country, so it kind of goes afield of Albemarle.
Oh, cool.
It does, yeah.
Great. Rick Britton, our guest, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Before we continue our discussion, last week we were talking about the Civil War. Before we continue that discussion, there is some legislation being entertained, and it looks like it's going to pass in the General Assembly, to designate the ginger gold apple as Virginia's official state fruit.
So is that a native apple?
The ginger gold is native.
Right.
I actually looked it up online.
Right.
It was discovered in Ginger Harvey's orchard, up around Winchester, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So it is native. But my first thought was, well, what about the Albemarle Pippin?
Yeah, what happened?
Yeah, how did the Albemarle Pippin get passed up? Because that was huge. I mean, that was internationally a famous apple from right here in Albemarle County. And I know you've done some research on the
Yeah,
on the
I looked
Pippin.
That up. Yeah, we corresponded about this via email. Yeah, it turns out that there was an ambassador to England, and I think his name was Stevenson, who was from Albemarle County. And we're talking about the 1830s, I believe, 1830s, 1840s. And he brought a basket and had Queen Victoria try it, and she adored the Albemarle Pippin. And then what happened was, and I had initially thought that they had made the Albemarle Pippin the official apple of Virginia, as you thought, too. But what they really did was, because she so much enjoyed this Virginia apple, which is not a native, by the way, is originally from England and then to Albemarle County via New York State, what she did was she lifted all of the import duties on Virginia agriculture products, agricultural products. And so that lasted, which, as you can imagine, was a huge boon to Virginia farmers, and especially apple growers.
And it was all because of this Albemarle
Pippin. It was because
Pippin.
She so loved the Pippin. And that actually lasted until just after World War I, when I guess they said, well, wait a minute, it's not fair to, you know, to let all this Virginia stuff get in and not this North Carolina stuff or this Georgia stuff. And so they put the import tax or the import duty back on it. So that's the fame of the Albemarle Pippin.
And it's not really it's sort of hard to find these days. I mean, you don't go into a grocery store and find the Pippin.
Right.
And it's even hard to find around here.
And the big orchards were out in Crozet. And Crozet for a while was the apple capital of Virginia. They grew apples and peaches out there outside of Crozet in these huge orchards.
Yeah. And folks should know that this was a huge part of the local economy here.
Absolutely.
Was just growing this fruit, which we really don't think today. You sort of think that it's, I don't know, you sort of think of apples in Virginia. It's something you do in the fall. You take the kids up to Carter's Mountain. And you pick apples and buy apple cider. But this was a major part of the Central Virginia economy for a long time.
That's right.
But no more. Not a major part.
Well, just a little bit.
And of course, it looks like the Albemarle Pippin is going to get passed up for the ginger gold, which is, I guess it makes sense because that's another successful apple, and it is, in fact, a native.
Right.
A native Virginia apple. So perhaps I guess
that makes sense. It makes sense.
Rick Britton, our guest, local author and historian. Last week we talked about the 19th Virginia, which is the regiment of local soldiers who stepped forward during the Civil War.
That's right. Of the regiment's 10 companies, and typically a Civil War infantry regiment had 10 companies. Of the 10 companies, 7 were from Charlottesville and Albemarle County. 2 were from Nelson, and 1 was from Amherst. So they're all basically from, the Piedmont, the central Piedmont. You know, one of the things that was interesting, I talked about, and I thought about this for a while and jotted down a few things here to tell you, but the unit, as I mentioned before, last week, was formed in Manassas. But if you look over the roster, it's really amazing because you see so many familiar names. The unit was full of Shiflets, Hamners, Says, Breedens, Maupins, Omahundros. So you see Norrises, Morrises, the names you still see
family,
today.
Yeah, and families that have been here for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so it's kind of neat to look over the roster, you know, the guys who made up this unit, and it's the names you still see today. It was kind of interesting when you filled out, you had to fill out a little paper when you volunteered, and these men were volunteers initially. And you had to say what your occupation was. And, of course, it ran the entire gamut in the 19th Virginia. And, of course, because of the University of Virginia, a lot of them were students. 4 men listed their occupation as gentlemen. So they were well-to-do enough to just be gentlemen. That's all they had to say.
It's interesting that was an occupation.
That's right. That's their occupation. In other words, really, it's nothing, right?
Right.
No occupation. He probably sits and reads, you know, and studies Bell letters, right? One guy was an ambrotypist.
What's that?
Which is great. A photographer.
Oh, that's what they called it?
Yeah. Well, ambrotype is a certain type of early photography. You know, you had tintype and various others, but ambrotype. So one guy was a local photographer. Then another thing of interest was the different commanders. The first colonel that commanded the 19th Virginia, and for only a brief period, was Philip St. George Cock. And the interesting thing about him is you might recognize the name if you're an alum of the University of Virginia. Cock Hall was named for his father, John Hartwell Cock, who was a personal friend of Jefferson's, had been on the first board of visitors at the University of Virginia, and when Jefferson died, took over the supervision of the construction of the University of Virginia. And so that's an important name, a big family here in Central Virginia, even though they were from Fluvanna County. Philip St. George Cock, unfortunately, evidently had these radical mood swings, probably suffered from manic depression. He became a brigadier general. He's the only general, North and South, during the Civil War, to commit suicide during the war. And he did down at Bremo, which was the family estate, still down there, owned by the family, I think it was the winter of 1862. But the only general in the Civil War to commit suicide.
What did he do?
He shot himself with his revolver, with his service revolver.
Wow.
Yeah, shot himself in the head.
Any letter, or did they leave suicide notes then, or is that a modern
thing?
People
did, but he did not. So that's kind of an interesting thing. The second commander was John Bowie Strange. And that's another family, a large family here from Central Virginia, but more from the Richmond area in Goochland. And one of the interesting stories about him is passing strange was a phrase people would say in the old days. It meant that's beyond weird. That is passing strange, almost like surpassing strange. It's beyond weird. It was a really common phrase in those days. You know, so many things have we don't use anymore, common phrases. And there's a famous moment during the Seven Days Battles when the 19th Virginia and Colonel Strange there along this road. And here comes Jeb Stuart, the cavalry commander, with his staff riding by. And he turns and points to him. You know, Stuart was the great jokester. Ah, gentlemen, we're passing Strange. Because he was passing Colonel Strange and the 19th Virginia. One of the last commanders was Henry Gant. And he was the colonel who actually led them in Pickett's charge. I remember I told the story about how his second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel Ellis, was killed by that cannonball. Another interesting thing about the 19th Virginia is the two companies from here in Charlottesville, the Albemarle Rifles and the Monticello Guard. The Monticello Guard, by the way, still exists as a National Guard unit. Early on in the war, In 1861, in fact, in April of 1861, you know, Virginia seceded, and the vote, originally the movement was kind of touch and go, and it wasn't until Lincoln called for Virginia's makeup, Virginia's militias to help suppress the rebellion, the sister states to the south, and that's what put Virginia actually into the Confederate camp. It was really a stupid move of Lincoln's. But when Virginia finally voted to secede, the news of the secession was withheld from the press for a couple of days so that a number of units could capture the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, which then, you know, today West Virginia, but then was in the state of Virginia.
Where there were a whole lot of guns.
There were a whole lot of guns, but also more importantly, the equipment, the machinery to produce weapons. Even more important than the stock of weapons, the machinery. Well, the Albemarle Rifles and the Monticello Guard, along with two UVA student companies, the Southern Guard and the Liberty Rifles, I think they were called, or the Liberty Guard, they formed a little unit that was an ad hoc unit that was called the Charlottesville and University Battalion, and they were taken up to Harper's Ferry in the night by train and participated in this, of course, this extra legal activity, you know, the capture of the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. And so I thought that was really interesting that these, you know, students at the University of Virginia. And another thing that kind of interests me is the fact that it was not even this whole movement to capture the Harper's Ferry arsenal wasn't even organized by the then current governor of the state, who was Governor Letcher. It was organized by the previous governor. So it shows you how much power, his name was Wise, it shows you how much power politicos had, that this man who was no longer even the sitting governor of the state of Virginia could organize this military movement to capture a federal arsenal.
Before,
kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Before Virginia had even publicly seceded from the Union,
right,
there's a military maneuver against the Federals.
Right.
And did they take Harper's Ferry?
They did. The man who was in charge of the armory and arsenal there set fire to it, and so they didn't get the weaponry. They got a lot of the machinery, and the machinery was moved via rail to Richmond, and so they immediately started manufacturing weapons to Richmond and to other points further to the south.
Yeah.
So it was in general a success.
I've read some student diaries of that expedition, and they were disappointed that it wasn't more of a fight. They went all the way up to Harper's Ferry, and they were sort of expecting this great, huge battle against Lincoln's men. And, well, those battles were to come, I guess.
That's right. They were down the road. And then later on, when they applied to be admitted into the Confederate Army, these student companies I'm talking about now, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee was his advisor at the time, they turned them down. And the reason they turned them down is these guys would go on to become officers, and they didn't want these young men of distinction, these young men of well-to-do Southern families, they didn't want them as common privates in the ranks. And many of them did, literally dozens of UVA students and alums, you know, became general officers during the war.
We're talking with Rick Britton, author and historian, and that's at rickbritton.com.
www.rickbritton.com.
And what's the end, the upshot of the 19th Virginia? What was the attrition? I mean, how many of these guys actually survived until the end of the war?
Well, that's kind of interesting. The end of the war for them was the Appomattox campaign, and
so they were there till the very end.
They were
in
there
Virginia,
absolutely till the very end. In fact, at Sailor's Creek, which was the last major battle that the Army in Northern Virginia fought, that was on April 6, 1865. There were about 55 of them in that battle, and it was a huge Confederate defeat. In fact, one of the worst defeats that any units of the Army of Northern Virginia, Lee's Army, ever suffered during the war. About half of them got cut off and surrendered. Nonetheless, on the Appomattox roster, there appear the names of 29 members of the 19th Virginia Infantry, evidently with the colors. So approximately 800 of them were at the First Battle of Manassas.
Oh, my gosh. And then there's 29 at Appomattox.
29. So I estimate there's probably about 2,000 or maybe a few more local men served in the 19th Virginia throughout the war. Of course, never all of them at the same time. It was kind of a revolving door.
And of those 2,000?
Of those 2,000, there were about 300 deaths.
Wow.
Yeah. And the vast majority of them, as we talked about before, from sickness.
Yeah, which was true north and south, all across
throughout the war. Right.
We don't have much time left, and perhaps this is something we can talk about next week in more detail, but let's sort of get into it now. This whole idea of what was going on the home front during the Civil War, what was happening in Charlottesville during the Civil War, and next time, next Friday, we'll really look at this idea of the invasion.
Okay. That's fantastic.
The quote-unquote surrender and the still debated, did they surrender, of the university.
Oh, that's a great story.
To the Federals who marched
on Charlottesville. Not that many people have written about what happened during the home front, I guess, you know, the major interest being the campaigns. But even for the soldiers, you know, the campaigns and the battles were just a tiny part of their experience, and usually it was just the everyday boredom. But here on the home front, people might be surprised to learn how many different companies there were, how many different manufactories there were of all of the materiel for war. So, you know, Charlottesville and Albemarle County, you know, went into this war effort wholeheartedly, you know, supporting the Southern Confederacy. I mean, there was of course, there were the woolen mills. At the time, it was really the cotton mills, and they were producing uniforms and uniform materiel.
Which is right down here in the Woolen Mills neighborhood down
that's
the river.
Right. Yeah. That's right. There were companies here in Charlottesville producing the leather goods, the accoutrements that the soldiers used, the cartridge box, the cap box, the various belts, but also shoes. There were at least two factories here in town producing swords and sabers for the cavalry.
Yeah, and the McKinney.
McKinney was one of them.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. Whose father actually founded the university bookstore at
that's
the corner.
Right. That's right. We've talked about him before. Yeah, he owned one of those factories.
Yeah.
So people here in the home front were supporting it, you know, by going to work and producing those things that were needed, the war material, but also growing the crops to feed the men in the field, growing the wheat that the men needed for the bread, and also, you know, nursing the sick and the wounded here.
Right, right.
Over 20,000, the vast majority, you know, 95% of those at least being Southerners, were treated here at the Charlottesville General Hospital all across town. So it was a major effort here.
Yeah, and just to remind folks, you can't go out and see the Charlottesville General Hospital.
Right.
It is Charlottesville. All the buildings, university buildings, homes, were collectively called the Charlottesville General Hospital.
Any space they could find, including, you know, homes, as you said, and the vacant student rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the university came close to closing because there were so few students.
At one point, they had them actually laid out on the floor of the rotunda.
That's right.
On straw, just because there was no room. And there were so many sick and dying soldiers that they were trying to save.
Yeah, it was a brutal war.
Rick Britton, it's always a pleasure and a joy. I always look forward to Fridays and having you in. And next week, let's look at this. We'll explore the idea.
The
invasion of Charlottesville.
All right.
In, what, 1865?
Well, there are two, 1864 and 1865. We've already talked about one.
At Rio Hill.
A fellow by the name of George Armstrong Custer is involved in both of them.
We'll talk about that next week with Rick Britton right here on Charlottesville Right Now. Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.